Disruption Zone. Opportunity lives where the status quo dies. Talking to the greatest innovators, disruptors, and off-the-wall inventors we can scrounge up. You laugh, you'll learn, you'll be inspired. Now, here are your hosts, Leland Conway and Cameron Mills.
Welcome back to the Disruption Zone. I'm Leland Conway, along with Pegasus Institute's Josh Crawford. Hey, man, how are you? Good to have you back.
I'm doing very well. How about yourself?
Good. You guys have put out basically a call for five recommendations on how the state should open back up with COVID and how we should handle the coming budget crisis, because we're going to get crushed when it comes to the budget. I was actually just talking to a friend of mine who's a county attorney, and he was looking at unemployment numbers in Kentucky, and we're at, I think, 32% right now. But if the trend continues, and once they count in what came in last week, we're looking at about 50% of the employable workforce out of work in the next few weeks in this state. That's pretty insane.
Yeah, absolutely. And so part of the road to recovery here is acknowledging those kinds of facts, acknowledging that there has been economic and social harm that has happened that no amount of policy, good or otherwise, can fix, but that good policy can help minimize some of it.
Right. Well, I think also just thinking about, you know, nationwide, we have municipalities and counties and states that are dependent on things like payroll taxes, income taxes, sales taxes, and when everything is shut down and when 50% of the workforce is out of place, that's 50% of your state budget. I mean, maybe not in total, because depends on who's actually got money and who's paying taxes. But at the end of the day, this is going to rock budget sheets everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. We have already seen here in Kentucky, general fund tax receipts in April fell nearly $433 million from last year. We had an associate fellow of ours, Stephen Gordon, who's a PhD economist, basically run some projections based on the 2008 recession. He looked at if the budgetary impact were half as bad as the recession, if it were as bad as the 2008 recession, or if it were twice as bad as the 2008 recession, what would the budgetary impact be for Kentucky? And in every one of those scenarios, we have to completely exhaust the rainy day fund and still end up hundreds of millions of dollars in the red.
Which we can't afford due to our pension situation and other problems in the state. You guys have come up with five recommendations. I want to start with a kind of a high overview, and then we'll dive into each one.
Sure.
But the high overview is that what you guys are saying, and I agree with, is we need to prioritize what the government must provide, and then we need to prioritize getting government out of the way of business and market forces so that those business and market forces can bounce back and get us back to budget levels that we need. I mean, that's sort of the high view I take from reading a synopsis, if you will, a summary of what you guys have put together. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that's right. There are core functions of government that are frankly as essential to recovery as some of those market forces, but then as it relates to certain other things, government needs to get out of the way and let the private sector start to reopen and rehire and get people back to work.
Recommendation one, try to do the same with less, but if need be, do less with less. This is, before I let you go on this, This is a tough pill to swallow for bureaucrats and politicians, because you're telling them that their programs have to go.
Yeah, I think this is the one that policymakers both most need to hear,
right,
and will also be most averse to. The reality here is that, and I mentioned this in the work that we did, is that nearly every empirical study that has been published in a peer-reviewed academic journal on taxes and economic growth has found that increased taxes limit economic growth. They vary in the degree to which they say increased taxes does that, but virtually every single one finds that increased taxes limit economic growth. And so given the specific nature of the recession that we're in, with over 14% of the United States workforce unemployed, with in a state like ours, 32 to 33% of the total workforce filing for unemployment claims. Raising taxes on those people, raising taxes on middle class families, is a remarkably bad idea. I have friends who think that the state needs more revenue. I have friends who think that the city of Louisville needs more revenue. Those are worthwhile policy conversations, and I look forward to having them in 2022.
Right.
But right now is not the time to try to fill those budget gaps with raising taxes.
So essentially the answer to that is, if you're telling us, I mean, I'm looking at this from the politician's point of view, if you're telling us we can't raise taxes, and by the way, I want to chime in here that I think raising taxes on the wealthy is a terrible idea right now too, because we will be depending on the wealthy, what there is left of them, to be the investors for the rebuilding of this economy. And if we immediately target, demonize, and tax them, we are going to slow down whatever recovery process we have, however long that may take. But the
absolutely
the next thing is that essentially, you know, a bureaucrat's going to say, but, you know, you're telling me I can't tax. Well, then there's a lot of things that can't be done. So you guys go to your second, idea, and that is, please insulate public safety, particularly law enforcement, from budget cuts. So let's drop back to what government is supposed to do as opposed to what we want it to do.
Right. The protection of public safety, and in particular law enforcement, is probably the most important affirmative responsibility of state and local government. So the thing that they are supposed to do that is most important. But in addition, the relationship between law enforcement and crime is a well-documented one. To put it plainly, more cops does equal less crime. And that we know that policing during a recession can reduce officer numbers via furloughs, if that's an availability that the locality has, but also in choosing to not bring on additional law enforcement officers as normal attrition happens.
Right.
And that will lead to increases in crime. And folks tend to like to point to the relationship between poverty and crime and say that poverty causes crime. But there's good research that also suggests that crime increases poverty. As neighborhoods experience increased property and violent crime, it drives out business, it limits economic opportunity, and can further economically depress an area.
Right.
And so one of the things that we have to make sure doesn't happen as a part of this recession is that we see increased crime in some of our already vulnerable neighborhoods.
Yeah. It's kind of weird. We actually get an opportunity to plan for a recession. I mean, we're in this, but we know why it's happening. And yet I still have a feeling our government's going to fail at it, because they're failing at everything right now. I don't know if you saw Thomas Massie's tweet yesterday, where there was a constituent of his who received their deceased mother's check for the stimulus deal. And it said right on the check that it had the code for deceased. So the government is sending checks that have the code right on there to dead people. And they know this. So it's like, I'm waiting to see how this wonderful government is going to get us through this. It's that's the most terrifying thing. You also suggest reducing barriers to entering the marketplace.
Yeah. So the primary way that this manifests itself on the state level is occupational licensing. There's some regulations that can be played with, but occupational licensing is the big one.
Right.
With such a large percentage of the workforce out of work, it is very likely that there are very high-skilled workers, high-skilled laborers, who will not return to their job immediately or at all based on the situation that their employer finds themselves in.
Right.
That gives the state an opportunity as much as it does something to be worried about, and that is to allow these folks to go into the marketplace for themselves. And one of the ways that government inhibits that is through occupational licensing. We released a report about a year ago that looked at Kentucky's occupational licensing statutes and basically proposed an alternative structure for this that would allow licensing to continue to protect the things that we need it to protect. There's very few people who argue that doctors shouldn't be licensed or right. that certain high-risk industry shouldn't be licensed. But ultimately, there's a lot of licensing. 19.4% of Kentucky's workforce has some sort of occupational licensing requirement for the job that those people perform. And that's estimated to cost Kentucky about 20,000 jobs. And so by removing some of these barriers, we can get some of these high-skilled laborers back into the marketplace and back into the marketplace for themselves in a way that they otherwise wouldn't be able to.
What does that usually cost? Because there's a lot of occupations that have licenses that come from the occupation itself, not even from the state. You know, if you have a doctor's license, you know, if you have your, you get a degree and all that, you get everything in your license by boards, you're done. So Kentucky comes along and charges another occupational license fee. But what's the point of that anyway? Because that doctor's already got the education that they need. It's already been certified that they are capable of doing what it is they're doing. So Kentucky just comes along and takes a scoop of the money. I mean, in cases like that where the state doesn't have to certify that you can do something that maybe some other organization already does, it's redundancy.
Absolutely. And so part of it is a revenue grab for the state, but part of it is also designed by industries themselves to keep folks out of the marketplace. It drives down market entrance and then as a result drives up the cost of those services because they can control the supply of labor.
Right. The fourth recommendation is reducing the cost of labor and easing the hiring back process. So you guys kind of dive into this a little bit, you know, with the state shutting down everything, significant reductions have occurred in consumer demand because everybody's sitting at home watching Netflix eating frozen pizza. So it's unlikely the U.S. labor market's going to bounce back right away. And I think there's some trepidation. I think some of our politicians and some of the quote-unquote experts have terrified people so much that even when we reopen, some people are just not ready to go back out again. So what do you propose to help cost of labor? You've mentioned a payroll tax holiday. How long would that last?
Yeah, so Dr. Arthur Laffer, who's one of our policy advisors, and Steve Forbes from Forbes magazine, had an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal on April 19th that advocates a payroll tax holiday basically through the end of the year.
Okay.
They estimate the cost of doing that would be about $800 billion, not million. But what it would do would overnight reduce the cost of hiring back an employee or hiring a new employee by 7.65%. It would also boost pay by that same 7.65% for the employees who are hired back or hired for the first time. And it's something that, as a part of the early coronavirus stimulus packages that we opposed, because it wouldn't be sufficiently targeted. There's little evidence that would actually increase demand or that it would lead to increased consumer spending. But when you're talking about allowing businesses to hire back as many people as possible, as quickly as possible, getting people back into the workforce in a meaningful way, it's one of the quickest and easiest ways to reduce the cost of labor that doesn't result in reduced wages. It would actually also reduce in a temporary increase in wages.
That number is staggering, though, $800 billion. And I think about, you know, I rarely ever think about taxes as costs to government. It's like, you know, you're taking too much money. And I like the idea of a payroll tax holiday, but what is the U.S. budget right now? $3.7 trillion a year? Is that right? I mean, this is like almost 25% of the nation's budget.
Yeah, and the downside here is that payroll taxes are specifically allocated to the Social Security and Medicare trust funds.
Oh, so you'd be putting them on pause, basically, in terms of the money going into them.
Right. What in all likelihood would have to happen is that general fund dollars would have to fill that gap.
Okay. So this wouldn't affect the $3.7 trillion regular budget of the country. This is money we're putting aside for Medicare and for Social Security. So we'd have to find some way to bridge the gap. Okay. From other taxes or other pots of revenue.
Right. So it probably wouldn't impact it in the short term, but the reality is with several months of no money going into those trust funds, which are already anticipated to expire, we would have to fill that gap somehow. The justification here, especially for a holiday, is that the situation that we find ourselves in is very unique.
Right.
It's the result of government telling people they can't work. It's the result of a pandemic virus. And so a short-term policy like this may give employers confidence to go out and rehire where they otherwise wouldn't. It to me is the thing that we include that I'm the most conflicted about. But I think ultimately for the short term, it's a better solution than additional direct payments or additional loans to businesses when we talk about recovery.
Well,
once we're talking about recovery, we're talking about trying to get people back to work.
Right. And you admit in here that you formerly opposed it, but now are supportive of it as a surgical tool. This is one of the problems with the response, the government's response as a whole, from the top all the way down. The one of the big problems I have with the government's response to COVID is that initially it was blunt force, which we had to. I mean, I get that. You know, for a while we had to go, what the heck is this? Everybody stop. Let's figure this out. But now that the data's coming in, we now know that the virus is far less deadly than was originally prognosticated. It's still worse than the flu, but it's magnitudes of levels less deadly than was originally projected. And we know the vulnerable populations. So now we must pivot to fighting a dynamic enemy in a dynamic way, which requires surgical precision. We don't need to shut down the entire economy. We need to keep the vulnerable populations at home and then have everybody else do common sense social distancing. So this is a surgical. So what you're talking about from a monetary policy is a surgical strike. It's like, look, you know, if we don't get everybody back to work, we're never going to be able to pay for these things anyway. And we can never really raise taxes, at least if we need to, until the economy is doing better and we can do it in a measured way. So the first thing we got to do is revive the patient. We got to get the defibrillator. And that's essentially, this is the defibrillator option for the economy, is what you're saying.
And the other thing and the final point that we make in that section is that ultimately, we cannot consume what we don't produce. The problem with paying people to stay home is that we don't produce anything. And you're seeing this in the supply chain questions around meat and meat packing. And obviously, you've had Congressman Massey on to talk about that at length.
Right.
But ultimately, we cannot consume what we don't produce. And so the longer you pay people to stay home and the longer that those people stay out of the workforce, the lower the production is, and the more that messes with supply chains.
Yeah. You said we can't sell what we don't produce. One of the folks that I work with on a daily basis had a quote the other day, and he said, you can't give what you don't possess. And I thought that was a really poignant statement, because when you think about like left versus right in America, there's this sort of ideological battle going on where the left wants to give what it doesn't possess. It wants to give, you know, the big push right now is universal income. And there's a lot of people that have been, over time, by our wonderful education system, stripped of the ability to think critically. And the $2,000 a month until we get through this, quote unquote, sounds really good. They don't realize that $2,000 a month of free money until we get through this means we never get through this, right? Because it's the government wanting, or politicians rather, wanting to give what they don't possess. And I think that's interesting. We can't tax what we don't produce either. We can't tax income that doesn't exist. We can't sell things that aren't produced. We cannot give what we don't possess. I don't know. It struck me when you said that there's a fundamental misunderstanding amongst much of the American populace about how the economy actually works and how to revive it in a situation like this. Our economy just had a massive heart attack. I mean, I don't think people have been able to wrap their heads around. We're watching Netflix and eating frozen pizza. We don't understand that what is out there is not going to be out there for us when we open back up. If that's postponed indefinitely, we've had a massive heart attack. We have to revive the patient.
Right. And I think part of that comes from folks trying to get policy wins as a result of this sort of like long-term ideological policy wins. Much like the tax increase question, the question of a universal basic income, and especially the question of a universal basic income in contrast to the traditional anti-poverty programs and entitlement programs, is a really interesting academic question.
Right.
And there are people sort of on both sides of the political spectrum who take both positions. It's a worthwhile conversation to have in 2022 once we're through this.
Right. Right now, I feel like it's just trying to get stuff out of what Elon Musk said the other day was the special unicorn horn or whatever it is that we're just trying to take stuff out of that. There's just no special unicorn horn. That's not where money comes from. Your final recommendation is to ensure adequate PPE for employees and customers. There's a lot of talk about PPE. The original idea of the shutdown was to keep the whole hospital system from getting overwhelmed. That never happened. There's a $6.8 million temporary hospital facility that's being taken down now over in Lexington because it never saw a single patient. There are other hospitals just like that, temporary hospitals that were built for housing 500 to 1,000 patients that never saw a single patient or maybe saw one patient. It just never materialized. Part of that was because the social distancing probably initially worked. But the point is, that's why we did this. But that means that hospitals and government should now be ready for any potential second wave of this virus, which means we should be able to open up, even if there is a second wave. Let healthy people gain herd immunity, protect the vulnerable. But where is that PPE? Why are we still talking about ensuring it? It's been 6 to 8 weeks. It should be there.
Yeah, so this particular point deals not just with hospitals, but other parts of the economy. The highest profile example we have here in Kentucky right now is that at a meatpacking plant here in Kentucky, both the local union there and our Ag Commissioner Ron Quarles have reached out to the governor to try to get those folks PPE,
right.
Folks who work in close quarters, who are touching things that other folks are touching, in order for them to get back to work before there is a vaccine or before there is a reliable and replicable sort of straightforward treatment. Those folks need PPE just like those doctors, frontline healthcare workers, law enforcement, things like that did. And the flip side of that is something that you said earlier about folks who have been scared to the point that they don't want to resume normal shopping and travel habits.
Right.
One of the things that will ease those fears is access to masks and gloves and will allow people to more quickly go back into the marketplace and resume normal shopping and travel habits. And so the PPE question is now a bigger one than just frontline healthcare workers and hospitals, but also needs to simultaneously deal with individuals who would work in close quarters and those who want to go out and shop and travel.
Right. So how likely do you think our government is to hear your recommendations?
Well, I think that there is a recognition, especially in the legislature, that things need to happen for us to move forward. I think that policymakers at every level, at the local, state, and national level, are looking for how to deal with the next step of this, which is the recovery step, the economic and social harm recovery step. And so I'm hopeful at this point that we can get some traction. Our legislature is constitutionally gaveled out right now, but some of these tax questions especially will remain relevant at the state level during next session.
Yeah.
And for local governments like Louisville, Lexington, all the small towns, all the small cities, all the counties that do their budgetary process in the summertime, it remains incredibly relevant for them. And so I'm hopeful that we can get some traction on this.
I am too. Josh, I'm glad you guys are here. The Pegasus Institute, for people that aren't familiar with you, they should be. You guys are doing an incredible amount of work on policy, and you've had quite a bit of influence in Kentucky, thank goodness. And it's not partisan. It's just thinking through what needs to be done in big situations that are affecting our state. And so people can find you guys at PegasusKentucky.org. That's your website. And you've got a ton of blogs, all kinds of information. You're covering the COVID outbreak intensely. So there's a lot of information on there about that. I mean, thank you for what you do, because it's important work. It's really important work.
Well, I really appreciate that, Leland, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk about it.
Yeah, anytime. You guys can always, you're always welcome on this forum for sure. Josh Crawford from the Pegasus Institute, thanks for your time, man. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, talk to you later.
Sounds good.
Look, if you go to PegasusKentucky.org, you'll see a ton of information up there about economic policy, and it's not partisan. It's just thinking it through. And one of the things I like about them is the flexibility they have in the way that they think. You know, the mark of an intelligent person is someone who can hold two seemingly opposing views at the same time, right? And they admit right in their recommendations, we weren't originally for the payroll tax, but now we're in a situation where we need a surgical strike. And so it's pragmatic in its processes. That doesn't mean it's the policy that should be in place going forward forever. It means that for now, this is what we need to do. And you will find that kind of thinking. It's not mired in Republicanism or Democratism. It's mired in independent thought. And that's why I have so much respect for the Pegasus Institute. Okay, numbers and figures, but it's important stuff. We've got Cameron Mills coming on this week. We're going to talk about this little kid who stole his parents' SUV to drive to California and buy a Lamborghini with $3 he had in his pocket. It's a really fascinating story. A five-year-old pulled over in Utah driving an SUV. We'll find out more about that. So you're going to make sure you want to stick around and hear all the episodes that we have coming out this week. I am Leland Conway. Thanks so much for listening. It's a free subscription at Apple Podcasts as well as Google Play, Spreaker, and iHeartRadio. Just go to iHeartRadio and search The Disruption Zone, and brand new episodes will be sent directly to your phone. We are getting thousands of downloads a week now, which is just phenomenal and humbling, and I appreciate it, and I appreciate you. And if you want to help, continue to help get this information out there, please share this with your friends and have your friends also download the podcast and check it out, okay? So I really appreciate you. You can follow us on Instagram. It's at GreatlyLondo and at The Disruption Zone. And you can follow us on Twitter at Leland Show and at Zone Disruption. Thanks to Dynamics Productions in Lexington, dxaudio.com, for all their help with the production on this program. And thank you for listening. I am Leland Conway. It is The Disruption Zone.